to Days Gone By. I'm Sandy Hackett, comedian, author, father. That was the fun part. I am being interviewed by Rabbi Saul Solomon on UNC Radio. We can GPS you, and the rabbi will come and perform an immediate circumcision.
Oh, shalom, shalom, goddammit. Is this Sandy Hackett? Hello?
Kidding me is that's how a rabbi starts to talk shalom, shalom, and then with an expletive? What, are you kidding me?
It's not really an expletive. I mean, there's other words that are worse than goddammit. I can't say that. Yeah, actually, I could say them on this radio station. So, all right, I'll say fuck. Let's just start with fuck. How are you? How the fuck are you?
I don't know how to answer that. I'm good.
Nor should you. Actually, let's start this properly, shall we? By the way, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Rabbi Saul Solomon. I am the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am always excited to be on the Dave's Gone By radio program of the air, usually talking to talented, fun people, sometimes funny people, comedians, like the one we have in the neighborhood today. His name is Sandy Hackett, and if certainly the last name sounds familiar, it is because he is the offspring. He is the sperm of Buddy Hackett, the great comedian who, by the way, would have turned...
Rabbi, yes. You have phlegm. Clear your throat.
Oh, please, I've the whole telephone is covered with phlegm already. I've just been hawking and hawking and hawking all day, all morning. At some point, like 6:30 in the evening, my throat clears, and I sound like Franco Corelli. And it lasts for about 5 minutes, and then I still sound like me again. But for those 5 minutes, I'm golden. Till then, I sound like this. And there's just pockets of phlegm all over my desk. It's horrible. Anywho, what the hell was I saying? Oh, yes, you, Sandy Hackett, are the son of the late, great Buddy Hackett, who would have turned, in Yirtzeh Hashem, 90 years old on August 31st. So, unfortunately, he did not live quite that long. But you went into the family business, Sandy Hackett. Were you preordained? Did you basically have to become a comedian?
I have no idea. You'd have to talk to a higher spirit. But let's get back to that. He would have been 90. At what point do we quit doing that? You know, is someone going to be talking to me in 30 years going, we're talking to Sandy Hackett, son Buddy Hackett, and if he was alive, he would have been 110 today.
Well, isn't that, what's wrong with that? I think that's a wonderful thing because it's an excuse, it's a reason to bring someone back into the public consciousness. If somebody has a centenary, 100 years old, 150. When the Beatles released Sgt. Pepper in 67, that'll be a big thing. Because, oh, remember Sgt. Pepper is 50 years old. Boom. You don't agree with that?
I was walking around going, you know, William Shakespeare, if he was around, would have been 472 today.
They do this in English departments. They do this in theater companies. It's, it may sound silly, but I think it's a lovely thing. Otherwise, you know, there's so many people in this world and so many things to remember. If you kind of don't give a reason to remember them, you're going to forget them, no?
I have no idea what we remember and what we don't. I think we remember the things in our life that give us pleasure, and my dad gave a lot of pleasure.
There you go.
Here we are only a couple days removed from maybe, you know, certainly... In the top handful of comedians of all time, the passing of Robin Williams, who wasn't Jewish but thought he was.
Well, he did a Jewish accent as well as I do, that's for sure. So, did your dad know Robin Williams? What do you think of them? Did you know Robin Williams?
I had met Robin on numerous occasions. I shared the stage with him a couple times, been in comedy clubs. I can't profess that we were friends, but I loved him and thought he was wonderful. Actually posted a picture of my dad and Robin together when Robin was over the house many, many, many years ago.
Oh, wow.
My dad loved Robin, and I hope Robin's pain has gone away. And one of the terrible things that has happened from all this is not with the loss of someone immensely talented and hugely funny and one of the best ever, but the assault on his family of the people on Twitter and the universe that want to write evil, mean, terrible things to his children who, you know, and being an offspring of a superstar comedian, I know what it's like to lose, but I lost him later in life when he had a full wonderful life, and it was his time to go. But I also shared him. He was my father, but I shared him with a planet. I shared him with all of his fans, and you can see the outpouring of love that's happened for Robin. And
I haven't seen the mean part. I mean, I don't know what you're saying about people posting.
People on Twitter wrote terrible things to his daughter. They wrote almost hate mail, and she's signed off of her Twitter account, and then they reopened the accounts to write more bad, evil, mean, jealous, vicious, disgusting things.
About him or about directly about her? I don't get it.
No, about Robin and about him, you know, the fact that it was a suicide and look, whatever it was unbecoming of being a human being.
Oh, well, that's but mostly me all the time. I'm still working on becoming a human being. Maybe one day, perhaps. But the one thing that I did hear about Robin Williams back when he was alive, and this is going back years ago, is that maybe it was different than a one-on-one situation, but if there was more than one other person in the room, he could not be on. He was always on. And sometimes it was just too much. You wanted to tell him, it's okay, you can be a person now. You don't have to be, the spotlight isn't on you. You don't have to be Mr. Funny Man right this second. And he couldn't help himself. Did you see that?
I never noticed that in my personal time with Robin, but I didn't spend hours with him. I didn't spend long amounts of time with him. But Robin could be just down to earth and be as normal as he chose to be. And maybe the person of that time caught him in a time when he was, doing drugs or, just bored.
He might have been on cocaine at that point.
People were there, so he took over the situation. I mean, I don't know what it is, but, Robin was Robin, and his talent was his talent, and it took him in so many places, and he was certainly different than most of us, but he was extraordinary in every way.
Now, let's get back to a person that you didn't spend a lot more time with, were closer to, your own papa, Buggy Hackett. Now,
but my dad also was always funny. If he liked that at home, my dad just did things funny. He wasn't necessarily on per se, but you could be sitting watching a ball game or the television, and something would come out of him, would just make you laugh. You know, if I got up in the morning and I wanted breakfast, he just cooking breakfast, him talking to you. He wasn't on telling jokes, but he was just funny. It was just his makeup.
Now, on your website, you even have posted, I don't know if you actually read this at his funeral, but you have an obituary there where you would get these phone calls from him. And in the phone call, all you would hear is a joke. He would call up, tell you a joke, ask your opinion, or I'm working on this joke, how is it? Was that really what he did, or did you just do that for the obituary, or what was that?
No, I have a show now about my father, and it's called My Buddy, and the website is mybuddyhackett.com. And it's a show, it's really a father and son show. It's me telling stories about my father. For all the interviews I've done like this, the people can ask stories about him. But my whole life, my dad never said, he never called and said, hello, how are you? What's going on in your life? How are you feeling today? It's just the phone would ring and he goes, two dunks walk into a bar. And he would just start going. Or whatever it was, he was telling a story. Or if he was preparing for something, he would, I'm doing the roast for Larry Flint. Here's what I got so far. And just start talking. He never, it was just his nature. And he knows he'd do it to me, but there's probably a handful of people that he would call and do the same thing with. Or if he heard a joke, or if he made up a joke, or whatever. He'd just start the comedy going early, first thing in the morning. And he was up early. He'd be up at 4. So you could get a call at 4:30 in the morning. And my favorite thing, the phone would ring and he'd go, are you up?
I am now, Dad.
Because he was up, you were going to be up.
But I have to say, I am a little bit shocked at hearing you imitate your dad, Buddy Hackett. And it is uncanny. When did you realize you could actually really, really sound like him?
I think I learned a long time ago that it just came kind of natural.
Wow. I mean, is it really? And when did you start doing it? What did he think of your impression of him?
What did he think of it?
Yes.
I don't know that I ever necessarily did it for him. There was no reason to do him for him. He sounded like. You know, what do I do, dueling Buddy Hackett with my father?
Well, you were on stage with him a couple of times, I think, so maybe that would have been a cute thing for the audience, you know?
Well, you know, and I used to do a joke. I think that's probably when it first started, because I did this joke, and it started out as a serious thing, because I was going out on tour with my dad, and I was talking to some friends of mine, and they said, comedians, and they said, where are you off to? And I said, oh, I'm doing a bunch of dates with my dad, because I toured with my dad for 10 years.
Wow.
And he said, wow, what a blessing. Boy, I would love to open for Buddy Hackett. You know, how cool would that be?
Right.
And it didn't dawn on me that this was somebody else's opinion from on the outside looking in. I was on the inside going, Dad said, you want to go work with me? I said, sure. So I said to my dad, we were probably, you know, a few days later, we were on stage, and my dad used to walk out on me pretty regularly. If I was in the middle of my act, he would just come out to see what I was doing. Hey, in his underwear, or his bathrobe, or his shirt, you know, whatever he felt like coming out, and that's what he came out. And I could hear the laughter behind me. I'd get a laugh with a joke, and then I'd hear a bigger laugh, and well, that's not for me. And here he comes in his underwear or his shirt tails, and he'd come and go, how's it going? And we start talking, and I said, I just want to tell you, one time I got maudlin with him on stage. I said, I want to tell you what a treat and a pleasure it is to be here with you. He goes, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, I was, before we left, I was talking to some friends of mine, entertainers, and they said, I told them I was going out on tour with you, and they said, boy, I would love to work with Buddy Hackett. What a thing for my career that would be. That would be so great. I'm like, you know, God, I'd love that. And my father looked at me and he said, fuck them, let them find their own famous father. And that got such a big laugh from him that I started to tell it as part of my stand-up act and as a story, you know, relating that to when people say, what was it like? And that was my dad's answer.
You know.
And so I started doing him, and I guess that's when I did it. It just, you know, I did it. Look, a lot of my friends, comedians, were impressionists. And I would watch them, and at first I couldn't do a voice, and I'd watch them, and then I'd learn how to do, you know, different people from watching my friends.
Well, who else do you do?
Who do you want me to do?
Well, no, in other words, of the people that we might know, are there any other comedians or entertainers?
This is Kermit D. Frogger. I'm very happy to meet you.
Oh, my goodness. You're very muffled, Kermit. Are you under the pond?
No, I'm under Miss Piggy.
That's actually very good. You're about as good as the younger Henson is these days, so well done. Who else? Who else do you do?
Well, I do a lot of people, but...
Oh, my God.
Where exactly?
Oh, I know who that is.
Who doesn't do me? Everybody does it.
What is the secret of doing Christopher Walken?
You know, I think the secret of any impression, and there are guys that do them... that just kind of rip them off. And then there are people that do impressions of people that have a love for them, a love for their talent, and get into the psyche of who they are and understand. I mean, I don't do any Christopher Walken from any of his. I just like the way he talks. I just like the way he watches life go by and comments on it. And then all the comic impressionists have exaggerated it to the point where it just becomes so discernible and fun, and it's just fun to talk like them. The opening of the show when you said those words, very uncomfortable. How the fuck could you do that?
Kevin Pollak probably still does the best walking, but a lot of people do him well, and you do him pretty well too. I have to say this. One more.
Kevin Pollak is a treasure. He's a funny bastard, and he started doing impressions, and that was his act. But now he's a fine actor. He's got a podcast. Jay Moore does a great Christopher Walken. Jay Moore does a great Buddy Hackett.
Oh, really? Wow. Let me ask you, what is the secret to doing a great Buddy Hackett?
I think the secret to doing all great impressions is having the love of the person you're...
Right, yeah, but I'm saying more of the
not
physical...
Not wanting to make fun of them, but to honor them and bring the essence of them to the stage.
Right, but I'm talking even more of, like, the persona, the voice, the... Is there something more tangible slash physical to doing your dad? Because I love, you know, I love your dad's comedy too, but I can't impersonate him.
Well, I mean, I could talk about other people. My dad was just so close. I lived with him my whole life. So there's different parts of my dad that I know and do. But the public image and persona of him is that he was funny, talked out of the side of his mouth, would say things funny. We had a Jewish kind of a New York bent to what came out. And he always looked at the world just a little askew.
Do you have a favorite Buddy Hackett joke or routine, and or a famous Buddy Hackett, a favorite Buddy Hackett movie?
Mad World. It was just the 50th anniversary this past year, and I went down to a screening. They wanted to do a Q&A with someone from the movie, but everybody's pretty much gone.
Oh.
And someone got a hold of me, and I sat there with the audience, and we watched the movie, and it still holds up after all these years. I think my favorite moments were on The Tonight Show with Johnny. I mean, they were like a comedy team. My dad had more performances on The Tonight Show as a guest than any other comedian.
Wow.
And Johnny and my dad were just poetry in motion. Johnny was the quintessential setup guy, audience. I mean, Johnny worked so hard and made it look so easy to make his guests look wonderful. And those days are gone. But I hear the other late night hosts talk about Johnny. And they all talked about him with reverence, and he was the blueprint, he was the model, I wanted to be like him, he's the guy I watch. I miss Johnny, and I miss my dad and Johnny together. It was just gold.
Were you ever on The Tonight Show? You were on Laughing a bunch of times, but
I was on The Tonight Show. I was on The Tonight Show when I was 15 years old. My dad was doing it in New York, and I was in the green room, and Johnny said, your son is here, well, can we say hello to him? And my dad said, you want to say hello to my kid? Sure, bring him out.
Oh.
And I came out, and I actually have the clip, because they posted a lot of Johnny's stuff now. You can go to, I think it's johnnycarson.com, and you can order the clips. You can license stuff or buy stuff, and I was able to find it on there. Me at 15 years old. I was actually 14 years old.
Wow.
I corrected Johnny. He said, so where do you live? And I said, you live in Beverly Hills. And I said, that's Hills, sir. And everybody broke up. I'm correcting Johnny. Little did I know.
But let me ask, in trying to be your own person and your own comedian and have your own creative life, was there a point when you either had to separate a little bit from your dad, or was it really tough when your dad got older and left the planet, then picking up and still having your own career as an actor and comedian?
Well, the problem is you're starting out in this business and you are the offspring of someone and you keep the same name, everybody identifies you immediately and go, that's so-and-so's son or daughter. And then they expect you to be a younger version of that person. Unfortunately, when you're a comedian, it takes a while to become good at what you're doing. And my dad said it takes 10 years to become a working comedian and 20 years to become a great comedian.
Wow.
In my 20s, I was neither. I wasn't working or great. I pretty much sucked, and I was learning my craft. But people remembered that they saw Buddy Hackett's son, and he wasn't very good. So that was a problem for me. And I remember the first job I ever got, I was actually with my dad in Atlantic City, and he was working, and I had gotten my first job. My dad was there for 3 weeks. He was the second act at Resorts International when they first got gaming. And I said to him after about the second week, I said, I'm leaving. He goes, what do you mean you're leaving? And where are you going? I said, I got a job. What job you got? You got to leave me. I said, I got a job as a comedian. And his face filled up with tears. Tears just streaming down his face. And he was crying because he knew how tough a business this was and didn't want me to go into it.
Oh.
And he thought for a second, and he says, what name are you going to use? I said, what? What name are you going to use? I said, Sandy. No, last name. I said, Hackett. Why? He goes, all these years I spent building up the name, I hate to see you fuck it up in one outing.
Oh, God. Thanks, Dad. How'd you respond to that?
Well, you know what? My dad's comedy came from truth, and he knew I wasn't ready yet. But I went to this job. I actually got booked in Omaha, Nebraska. It was the first gig I ever had. And my dad, before I left, he gave me a joke book. and he said, learn every joke there is. And then, this is before cell phones and pagers and beepers, so call me when you get to the hotel. And I called him at the hotel, and he's calling me every 10 minutes. Here's another joke you could do tonight. Here's another joke you could do tonight. Here's another joke. And he kept giving me jokes, and my whole career, he would call and give me jokes. If I got booked somewhere, and then once I realized what a resource he was, I would call him. Dad, I'm doing a thing in Chicago. I got booked for the Plumbers Association. You got any plumbing jokes? Oh, yeah, here's two plumbing jokes.
Oh.
It's the best. So even though that one time he said to me, I hate to see you fuck it up on one night, it was honest. I wasn't ready, but he helped me every step of the way. And I said to him a few years later, I said, boy, someday I'd love to work with you. And he goes, someday. And I put my 10 years into comedy clubs, working wherever I could, getting up wherever I could. And one day he was coming to town in Las Vegas. I was working at the comedy club, and he came in a night early to come see me. And he watched everybody on the show. He saw me, took us all to dinner. And after the show, all the comics said, will you come watch the second show? Because he'd given us all advice.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff like that. And, we said, and he said, yeah, I'll come back. And then after the second show, he and I went to go get a drink or something somewhere, and he goes, you're ready. And I said, I'm ready? He says, yeah. He says, you're ready to come work with me. He says, I'm going to book you on some jobs. And that was the beginning of working with him for 10 years.
That's right. And were you also on some level his agent and manager or not?
Well, when I was in college, I started promoting him in colleges. I sold him to colleges and put him on tour in colleges. He used to work Las Vegas, and he worked in Florida. Then Atlantic City came along. But I started booking him in colleges around the country.
Wow. So was there a certain point again when you were with him for 10 years doing that day after day, week after week? How did that sort of end?
It ended when we had done about a decade together, and that was probably 25 to 30 or 40 shows a year, depending on the year. That's all he was working at the time, and I put in a decade with him and got a lot of advice, got a lot of stage time, got a lot of, we toured together, we drove in the car, we stayed in the same room. I mean, I had the best teacher on the planet teaching me everything he knew, and one day he said to me, it's time to fly. And he said, it's time to go off on your own. He said, if I carry you forever, you'll always be just my opening act. And he said, you got to go out and go earn a living. I taught you everything I could, and I love you, and it's time to go off. And so I did understand. I've been working, even the time I worked, I only worked 30 or 40 shows a year with him, 25 to 40 shows a year. So I was always working by myself anyway.
Oh, okay.
I'm to a point of proficiency that, I no longer needed. He's taking me to theaters around, taking me to performing arts centers and colleges and nightclubs and all kinds of things, and I was ready to go off on my own. There is a story. Frank Sinatra offered my dad to be his opening act many, 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 many years ago, and my father turned him down. And the agent said, why would you turn down Frank Sinatra to be his opening act? He said, I don't want to be Frank's opening act. I want to be his competition across the street.
Wow.
He understood that if you become Frank's opening act, that's all you'll ever be, is Frank's opening act.
Look at Frank Sinatra Jr. Yeah, exactly. Just kidding.
Right, so he gave me the benefit of his own actions many years later when he said, luckily all this time you've been working by yourself and doing things for yourself, but it's time for you to go off and be you.
Well, you were already basically primed and ready to do that, but being a comedian is a tough thing. I've noticed that over the years you've morphed more into an MC and a producer. Do you still do stand-up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely I still do stand-up. And the role that I do in our Rat Pack show, Sandy Hackett's Rat Pack show, is I played Joey Bishop, another stand-up comedian, a family friend.
Oh, wow.
And Joey has a monologue in the show. He also has several other bits that he does that are funny and humorous and extemporaneous. And yes, I still do stand-up. I don't do as much as I used to. I used to have a comedy club when I was on stage. I used to do 400 or 500 shows a year.
Oh my God!
I don't do that. I don't do that anymore. But I became a father, and I spend, you know, really, my kids are number one, and I go out and work when I have to, or when there's something I really want to do. But I'd much rather be a dad.
Why did you
life now?
I want to know what it was like running a comedy club, and why did you stop running a comedy club?
I love running a comedy club because at that point, and I think I opened a comedy club in 1990 in Laughlin, Nevada. And prior to that, we had the 80s. In the 80s, comedy was hot. And if you're a comic, you went all over the place. And I think I spent 5 years in the 80s, maybe 6 or 7, I don't even remember anymore, where every single week I was on a plane or in a car or on a train, on a boat, you know, going somewhere. And you get to where you're never home. You have no life. Your life is the road. It's exciting at first, and then one day you go, you know what? I want to have a life. I want to see my friends. I want to have a relationship. I don't want to be out here anymore. So an opportunity presented itself to open my own comedy club, and that meant that I would be home. I would bring the comics to me. I didn't have to go to the other places.
Right.
And I could start to have a life.
So you did.
And it was great.
Yeah. Why did you stop?
I stopped when the hotel went into bankruptcy and changed ownerships. I actually lasted through 3 different ownerships, and finally the last guy came in, and God, I hear great things about the comedy club. It does great business for the hotel. We love it. It's wonderful, and I want to sit and talk to you and do more things with you. And then about 2 or 3 weeks later, he called me into his office and said, get out.
Oh.
I said, excuse me? I mean, it was just that cold-blooded. Get out. And I think the problem was here was a new guy coming to take over a property, and I was the most identifiable thing with the property I'd become over 8 years. And I believe he was jealous, and he wanted to put his own stamp, so he got rid of me, the most popular thing on the place.
Was that really an awful moment, or were you kind of ready to move on anyway?
Absolutely devastated because I was fired for being excellent. It wasn't like I got fired when I was 21 years old from my first comedy job in San Francisco at the Fairmont Hotel, working with Jim Bailey, and I got fired for being awful. And now it's a lot of years later, and I get fired for being the best thing that there is, and me personally, but also the way we ran the business, the way we ran the club, associated with the hotel, doing great business. We did 8 shows a week, Wednesday through Saturday, and on 3-day weekends, we always worked Sunday and did 2 more shows. And I got fired, and I went home that night because he said I could finish out the week, but I didn't have to.
Yeah, so why would you? Yeah.
Because I had comedians booked there, and I wanted to give them the opportunity.
Oh.
I didn't say, oh, you're done tonight, you're not going to get paid.
Sure.
So
sure.
He let me finish the week, and I called my dad. I drove home, and I told my dad what had happened. He said, you know what you got to do? And I went, well, thank God. My dad, who's always been my backstop and the sage giver of advice, had a solution for me. And I said, no, what? He said, pack.
Hmm. Pack,
and
get back on the road, go away. Don't look back.
Well, it wasn't go back on the road. I had to pack. It was time to leave. Your
yeah.
time there had come to an end, and it was time to move on. So it was an incredible experience. Loved doing it. I booked 3 acts a week, so 150 guys a year. Over 8-9 years, I booked, you know, a lot of guys came back that did well. It was a wonderful experience. And from that, I opened another club in Flagstaff, Arizona. We opened in Las Vegas.
Oh.
It was very special. And it was fun, but then it was time to move on and do other things.
Now, I do want to ask, did you ever keep tabs? How did the hotel end up doing after you were canned from it? Did it burn down? Is it still there? How did that asshole make out after you left?
He didn't last long.
Good, okay.
And that's what he was. He was an asshole, and I don't know whatever happened to him, but I don't care.
Of course.
And the hotel struggled. I was the most successful thing. And when they got rid of me, they got rid of, you know, anywhere from 200 to 400 people a night came into the property. From 70% of our business came from outside the property. So I was the biggest draw on property. They tried other shows, other things, other this, but I was very integrated into the community in Laughlin. I was on television down there. I was friends with the newspaper editor. I did all kinds of charitable events, help things, and I'd become part of the scene. And when people wanted to go out for comedy, they called me. In fact, Sam Kinison was on his way to Laughlin when he was, you know, in a car accident hit by a drunk driver coming the other direction. And when the news came out that Sam had been killed, all the news outlets called me because they thought he was coming to work at my club, but he wasn't. He was headlining at the Riverside Hotel, but everybody called me.
Did you know Sam?
I did know Sam.
And what was he? Did he have an off switch?
Sam had a lot of switches. He also had a lot of demons.
Okay.
But he was brilliantly funny. He was so... What I loved about Sam is his comedy came from a place that was so brutally honest that you couldn't help but feel his pain and laugh with him at the way he made fun of it.
But did you see, and I guess you don't like speaking ill of the dead, but he's dead. I mean, did you see the demons?
Oh, absolutely I saw the demons. But when you say speak ill, if I thought he wasn't funny, if I didn't care about him, but I knew him and I liked him and I spent time with him, I never did drugs, so as soon as anything like that was happening, I left, because that just wasn't my scene.
Uh-huh.
But to speak ill of him, for the people that get into the drugs or whatever, you know, the alcohol, to speak ill of them for that reason, I don't know. Were they mean? Did they do bad things? That's when you speak ill to people. The guy who fired me for no reason because he was jealous of me being the most successful thing there, he's a prick.
Right, but Sam was not. He was just, he had demons, but he was never bad to you. You never saw him do anything bad to anyone else except himself with chemicals.
Well, look, Sam used to have a bit on stage where he'd find somebody, a guy in the audience, did your girlfriend leave you? Let's get her on the phone. And he would literally, he'd have the phone hooked up and call people. He'd call the guy's girl, you have her number? Yeah, let's call her. And then he'd start yelling out, you bitch, you are, you fucked up Bob's life, how could you? Then the audience would be screaming. You could hear the woman go, who is this? What are you doing to me? and it was brilliant.
I will second that.
He was getting out his revenge from his own life, from the women that had, you know, done that to him.
I remember, I have to cut in here and say that I will back you up 2,000% on this. I remember seeing him years ago at the Westbury Music Fair, and he wasn't on. He wasn't that good for the first part of the show. He was kind of a little bit lost and a little bit not so great. But he closed with that bit where he got the guy out of the audience, and he got the phone and started, and the audience went berserk. It was, you know, he saved the show with that routine.
Well, my father said it takes 20 years to become a great comedian. And the reason it takes 20 years is you have to develop an inventory of material. The problem with today's world for comedians, as soon as you can get good enough to get on television, everybody wants to be on television. You get on television for 6 minutes, you're hot. Now they want you again. Now what are you going to do? You've only been a stand-up for 3 years. You don't have hours of material and stories you can delve into to be a great panel guest or to be a great stand-up. So you struggle while you learn your craft on television instead of in the clubs, on the road, in places where you're trying to improve.
Well, although the problem, well, it's not really a problem, but the other side of that is they figure if they do the 3 years, they get the 6 minutes, they get their bit, then they get the sitcom, they don't have to be a comedian anymore. They just want to get on a show where somebody else is writing all their stuff, and they make $1 million a week, and that's what it is. But it only happens to one out of 10,000 people.
Right, everybody wants the same goal, but it doesn't happen to everybody.
I mean, did you ever try for that brass ring, the sitcom thing, all of that? Oh, we're getting feedback from your phone here. I'm hearing myself in an echo chamber now. This is not good.
Well, then you should ask yourself some questions.
Okay. Shalom, Rabbi Sal. How you doing?
I'm good.
How are you, Rabbi Sal? I've got this blister on my foot. It's not nice. I'm hoping to lance it later. But
is that film, is it still echoing?
You don't echo, I do. Hold on. Yes, I'm still echoing. I don't know what the hell's going on here. It's like we're in a cave. Where are you driving?
I'm driving home. I actually took my mother-in-law this morning to dialysis.
Oy. No jokes about that. I'm sorry. How is your mom, by the way?
Don't speak. speak to her.
Okay. Is that, that's not a joke? You,
that's not a joke. You,
she was married to your dad for 50 years. You don't get along with your mother?
After my father passed away, my family just, it literally just fell apart. My mother is now married to a convicted felon, 24 years her junior.
Okay. Did her personality completely change after she was married to your dad?
To me, it did. She became someone I didn't know. She feels the same way about me, and therefore, we don't talk.
I'm sorry to hear that. Do you have siblings? Do they feel the same way?
Same way. Same thing.
Well, do you get along with your siblings?
Nobody talks in the family anymore.
What that? This is a horror. How would your dad feel about all that?
I'm sure he'd be horrified.
Because I was going to ask about your mom later, because he talks so much about your dad. She had to put up with having two comedians in the family for years and years and years. That can be tough on a lady.
And I think that was a problem. Ultimately, I think my father, my mother, you know, I think she married my father so young, and this is speculation on my part, that she was, got lost in becoming Mrs. Buddy Hackett instead of becoming herself. And never got to be just her. So,
and she did act a little. She was in a movie or two. Did she feel like she wanted a career in the field also?
No, she wasn't. She wasn't a performer. She did something once, like a walk on or a cameo, but she was never pursued the business.
Oh, okay.
But so, you asked me about pursuing the business. I've done pilots for the sitcom. I've done probably half a dozen pilots. I've done 8 or 10 films. You know, I just haven't had that film that, you know, or the role that broke out that got me the next job. I've had my opportunities. They haven't panned out. I'm still pursuing it. My children are amazingly talented. My son is going to be 14. He's an amazing singer. And I married the woman I married. Her father was one of the great music songwriters of all time. Ron Miller, who wrote For Once in My Life, Touch Me in the Morning, If I Could, Yesterday.
Oh, my.
Christmas. I've never been to me. And you should interview her because she's magnificent and her father was Jewish and she produces the videos for our show.
Oh.
Produced the videos for our son who's already shared the stage with Stevie Wonder.
Well, Stevie Wonder didn't know it. He snuck on and just kidding.
Stevie Wonder what?
Stevie Wonder didn't know it. He thought he was on stage alone and then you know somebody else was up there. He had no idea.
Gotcha.
It's a blindness joke. Come on. I guess I need 20 years of stand-up comedy experience to be great. Oh, well. Oh, well. Did you give your son a bar mitzvah?
No.
Your son? Your 14-year-old son is not bar mitzvah.
Is not bar mitzvah.
Why not?
I think we're much more spiritual than we are religious.
Even so. What the hell? Why, he can't write from the Torah a little bit, become part of our greater people?
I guess I just feel different about it than you do. I consider myself a Jew, and my wife is, her father was Jewish, so, you know, we consider ourselves Jews, but the tradition of a bar mitzvah just wasn't something that overly appealed to us.
Huh. We are definitely on different sides of the fence on this, I'm sorry to say. I mean, you went to Israel when you were 19 years old. What was that like?
It was a trip originally I didn't want to take at 19, and my dad said, your mother wants to go, and you're going. I mean, I'd left the house, I was moved out, I was in college, and I went. It was amazing. History of the country is unbelievable. I mean, you go places, and you can feel the history. You can feel the era of time that you were in and the things that went before you. I remember walking the stations of the cross for Jesus. I remember being in, we were in Bethlehem on Christmas Eve, and they set up where they say the manger was that Jesus was born. Went to the Holocaust Museum. We were there when I was 19. We were staying in the Tel Aviv Hilton, and there was a busload that left in the morning of people that we'd met in the lobby and were talking to, and the bus was blown up, and this girl lost her leg. I mean, I experienced everything there in just a few weeks, and it was horrifying and unbelievable, but it's, I'm an American. I live in the United States. I support Israel. And, you know, I've helped in many ways. I've been in part of fundraisers and dinners and all kinds of things.
Good. You're making me much happier now than with the bar mitzvah stuff. So,
well, but Israel's an amazing place and it's amazing history. But you know, to say to have a ceremony, I was bar mitzvahed, and when it was all said and done, I didn't feel. I look back on it and go, what did that change? It just was like a big party for your parents to have because the Jews, your religion says this is what we do. I mean, you know, and I said to Oliver when he became 13, I said, you know, in the tradition, we talked about him being bar mitzvah. You are now a bar mitzvah. You are now the age that the Jewish boy, and you know this, but I'm telling the listeners,
right,
becomes a man. And you take on responsibility for your own sins. And I had that conversation with him. I said, so ostensibly, you need to understand that in the past, I was allowed to take on your sins as my own, ask for forgiveness for them, but now you're old enough to recognize when you do something wrong. But Oliver is an amazing kid. He's an amazing human being. He's just such a good person.
But don't you realize, Sandy Hackett, that you deprived him of the most important element of the bar mitzvah, not the spirituality, not the convocation of Jews, not the reading from the Torah, but getting envelopes stuffed with money.
Being what?
But getting envelopes stuffed with money. Punchlines always suck when you have to repeat them. I hate your telephone, I do. But before we say a fine shalom to Sandy Hackett, let's talk a little bit more about some of the people that you either had at your comedy club or worked with over the years or knew over the years or you had even on your talk show. Did you know George Carlin?
Yes, I knew George Carlin, and I interviewed George Carlin on two or three different occasions. I knew George. I loved George. He was funny. He was a nice guy. He was fun to sit and talk to. He was very bright, very well read. I loved his wife, Brenda, who I knew. Also, I had met her with George, and she actually cast me. She was casting a TV pilot, not a pilot, but a special, a Rich Little special for HBO, and put me on it where I got to do Rosanna Dana.
Oh, my God. So that's that. And what about Shelley Berman?
Shelley Berman, I met. I knew. I remember my dad took me one day. Shelley was working in Las Vegas at the Plaza in a show, and we went to go see the show. He was an actor in the show, and I think it was Neil Simon, the Last of the Red Hot Lovers or something. And after the show, we went backstage to see Shelley, and he was sitting there in tears. And he looked up to see my father, and he said, "It's so good to see you." And my dad said, "What's the matter? You were wonderful." He said, "My son has brain cancer. I'm here working just so I can pay for his treatment."
Oh, my God. Did you know what happened to his son? Did he survive, et cetera?
It's so many years ago. I don't think he made it. I think he succumbed to the illness, and it crushed Shelley personally on every level.
I can totally imagine that. And speaking of losses, someone that we... Oh, God, I hate your telephone. Someone we lost fairly recently, Jerry Vale, the singer.
Jerry Vale was great friends with my dad, was over at the house 1,000 times. I hung out with Jerry Vale. I worked with Jerry Vale. I opened for Jerry Vale.
Okay, any memory, any anecdotes?
Do I remember what?
Any anecdotes?
No, I don't remember any anecdotes from Jerry, but Jerry was a great laugher. Jerry came over to hang out because my dad made him laugh.
Well, that's wonderful. That's what it's all about. Now, as you said, you're a family man, and you get to do the life that you want to live. You get to work when you want, on projects that you want. How often do you go out with the Rat Pack Tour? Do you bring it just on the East Coast? Do you bring it all over the country? How much time do you expend on that?
They book the show. We go out when we're booked. We've got a show next week down in Seal Beach in Leisure World. We're in Rhode Island. Going back to Theater by the Sea, we were there at the beginning of the summer and broke all kinds of records and set records, and so they're bringing us back at the end of the season. They've never, ever done that before, but we're going back for a week at September 9th through 15th. We've got shows in other places, but you can go on our website, sandysratpack.com, and find us. That's what we do. We go out when there's work, and we're also booking my buddy. My wife's, you know, producing videos, working on a new show, so...
When and where is My Buddy being done? I would love to really come see that in New York or somewhere, yeah.
We're in the middle of finding that out. This is, you know, the agents are selling, so we'll see where we end up this season.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Sandy Hackett, for being with us in the neighborhood. It's been a delight to talk to you, not just about your dad, but about you, your life, your comedy. I wish you much continued success, enough success that you can buy yourself a decent goddamn telephone.
All right.
Have a good one, and shalom to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.